Ahmed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
Kneel before Zod!
Welcome to the Kneel Before Zod cast, or as I refer to it, my weekly political therapy session. Are we really here again? Was Mike Harris really that good that we needed a sequel? Here's what I remember about the Mike Harris years. Mike Harris now boasts about cutting $400 million annually from colleges and universities, but fails to acknowledge that under his reign, tuition fees increased by 60% and student debt ballooned, while professor-to-student ratios fell to last place in Canada. I personally saw my tuition go from $1,700 my first year to over $4,000 my last year. Now, while tuition increased, OSAP loan maximums stayed stagnant. My courses went from being taught by professors and associate professors to teaching assistants. I saw the intramural sports programs I love cut, with user fees making it financially restrictive to take part in. I saw food prices in the cafeteria nearly double and a food bank being set up on campus. Some years I was lucky to get bursaries, but most years I was forced to work at least two part-time jobs to be able to go to school. All this did was take away from my school experience and give me a level of worry and stress that no student should ever have to face. It also distracted me from achieving higher grades. During this time, I was subjected to no less than three school strikes from educators to support staffs. Municipal downloading saw my transit fees skyrocket. One summer, my OSAP grace period was canceled. I recall being thrown out of a PC MPP's office for loitering when I dared ask them for help. I watched as friends were forced to leave school and forced into poverty. I saw Indigenous people being killed for protesting at Ipperwash. I saw fellow Ontarians die as a direct result of Mike Harris's policies in Walkerton. I saw Kimberly Rogers commit suicide as a result of the culture of distrust that permeated Ontario's social services during the Mike Harris years. Mike Harris left office in a fog of coroner and public inquests. People died because of Mike Harris. There's no hyperbole in that statement. There is an ingrained cruelty in the Common Sense Revolution and an ideological hatred of the poor and the students. In other words, people who would never support their government or party. Now history is repeating itself with Doug Ford. The same ideological aversion to education and to educators. The same cruelty towards the disabled and poor. Cuts to OSAP and tuition programs that would benefit low-income Ontarians. I see a government of bullies who are disenfranchising an entire section of Ontario's population in the name of efficiencies. This is a government that lacks vision and a plan for the future. Mike Harris politically radicalized me, and Doug Ford is going to do the same to my children's generation. I had never attended a protest or walked out of school or work until Mike Harris became Premier of Ontario. Mike Harris was my Richard Nixon, and now Doug Ford gets to be my daughter's Mike Harris. The cycle continues. Only this time, I will be at the protest with my daughter. I will walk out with her. I will not stand idly by while another Conservative government tries to steal the future of another generation of young Ontarians, and Andrew Scheer hopes to accomplish the same nationally. I will stand with the students. I have no funny quips or jokes to make. We are in a period of consequences in Ontario. Worse than the cuts of social programs and education is the hopelessness that follows. People have been replaced by numbers. We have become efficiencies that affect the bottom line and nothing more. Ontario is not a corporation, and governance comes with the responsibility for caring for all those that you govern, not just the ones who vote for you. And that's especially the vulnerable, and especially those who cannot speak for themselves. On this episode, I aim to give a name and a voice to those efficiencies that Doug Ford has found so easy to cut, so that he can give corporations and richest Ontarians the tax cuts they so richly deserve. Today I'm speaking with three Ontarians who have been directly affected by Doug Ford's cuts. Three people with a very personal story to tell. It is time to put names and voices to the efficiencies found by the Doug Ford government. First up is Susie Panofska-Guarcy, a proud autism mom and advocate. Her son is Frankie. He was diagnosed at 3 years old with stage 2 autism spectrum disorder. He is nonverbal and developmentally delayed. She paid tens of thousands of dollars out of pocket to provide applied behavioral analysis for her son. After finally getting off the Ontario Autism Program waitlist, their world was turned upside down by the Ford government's changes to the OAP. Here is my conversation with Susie. Thank you for appearing on my podcast, Susie. It's been I mean, to share your story with us, I really appreciate it. I think these stories are incredibly important to get out. And your tweet that I saw last week, the one that you had sent out regarding Frankie and his therapy, really, I mean, I'm an emotional person at the best of times, but I tend not to let emotionality kind of get into politics. But it really affected me, and it really kind of spurred me to, it's actually the motivation for me doing the podcast today. So thank you for sharing that. Thank you for getting it out. And why don't you tell me a bit about yourself and about Frankie?
Well, thank you for having me. At this point, it's a really vulnerable time for not just myself, but thousands of other families out there. And I really just feel like I have to spread my life out there, because there's no other way. I'm really being heard or recognized by our current government. I am a proud autism mom and advocate. My son is Frankie. He was diagnosed at three years old with stage 2 autism. He is nonverbal and developmentally delayed. So basically we were on a wait list through the old Liberal government, where we would have received equitable needs based on his individual needs funding, but that came with a wait list. And 2.5 years later, you know, my dream came true and we finally received that funding. And then once the Conservatives came into power, Lisa McLeod decided to change the whole program without any data or any real facts behind making the changes, and just decided to change them on her own, which would now give my son $5,000 a year, which I'm thankful for, but it's nowhere near the amount of money that he needs within a year.
Now, as far as the therapy goes, the therapy that you're currently undergoing with him, the one that you're on the wait list for, what would that cost you over a year? I mean, if you were paying for it yourself.
So I did pay it for myself before, actually. He was about 35 hours a week. And at that time, I was at a private center and I was paying out of pocket $85 an hour at 35 hours a week. So if you do the math, it's thousands of dollars per week because of his needs. And he requires a lot of them. At this point in time, he requires 27 hours a week, so it has reduced. But right now it costs almost $80,000 per year.
Now, your tweet on April the 30th, that was my introduction to you. And I'm just going to read the tweet out. Your Twitter account is at @SU_PANOV. Basically, it said, "My son, his future is gone. I'm in crisis. The changes to the OAP program have consumed me. I can't go on this way." You mentioned Lisa McLeod and Doug Ford. "He is not ready to go to school. He needs ABA. He needs to learn life skills first." Now, you know, because it was my introduction to you, I hadn't seen what had gone into before that, but it seemed to me that it was a person at their breaking point. Was that how you felt when you wrote that tweet? I mean, was that kind of your, or was that kind of the culmination of a lot of things for you?
Well, since February 6th, the announcement was made with all the changes, I'm basically in a crisis mode. I paid out of pocket. I've exhausted any type of financial means that I can continue to pay for my son. So we paid out of pocket previously, and to finally receive the funding, I am literally in crisis. I have exhausted lines of credits and loans because we did pay out of pocket previously amount of money, and my son regress. The amount of will now be funded, which is $5,000 per year, again, is nowhere near the amount that he requires. And I'm literally in crisis mode, not just myself, but so many families out there that I've met since the terrible announcement has been made.
Now, you had mentioned before that you were starting a GoFundMe. Can you give me some details on that?
Sure. The GoFundMe account, basically, I created a couple of days ago, and I was kind of, I don't know what to say, but I just feel like I don't want to beg people for money, but I feel like I'm left at that point, and this is what this government has made me do, because I can't let my son regress. Because if he stops ABA right now in his life, he's just not going to have a better quality of life in his future. And that's what I want. I want him to have an independent future. I want him to have a better life. I don't want him to be failed like many other adults with autism today who were failed by our previous governments. And I want him to have a future.
If you could send me the link to that, I'll gladly tweet that out for you. I don't think it's begging. I don't think that there should be any shame in asking for assistance. I think if the government is refusing to help, to provide the adequate support, I think it's incumbent on us as citizens, or myself as a parent as well, to do whatever we can to promote that. So I wouldn't feel bad about that if I were you. We have to do what we have to do, right? And I think that's one thing that I'm learning throughout this, you know, through the Doug Ford premiership and through this progressive conservative government, is that we're going to have to lean on each other more. And even if it's just having podcasts and getting people's stories out there, I think that's the first step. And I'll gladly help you promote that. Now, what's the difference in your experience between the previous and current governments?
Well, the previous government in 2016, which was under Kathleen Wynne, the Liberals, they actually wanted to stop funding at 5 years old for children with autism. So any child under five would have been funded, but any child over five would basically receive no funding. So the autism community fought very hard. And after much understanding through Kathleen Wynne, she understood her mistakes, apologized, and worked together with lots of families and clinicians and stakeholders, and together came up with a individual needs-based plan that gave funding per child based on their needs, which unfortunately comes with a wait list. But through all the families that I've met during protests and gatherings and events that are on the wait list, they've all indicated to me that they would rather wait a year to 2 years to receive individual needs-based therapy than to just receive a minimal amount that would provide very minimal support for their children.
I don't have the same experience as you. I didn't really understand what was occurring previously when Kathleen Wynne wanted to put the age cap in. But I do recall Lisa McLeod and other conservatives being very vocal about it and promising to be better advocates for you. Did you expect better from this government, or is what's happening what you expected?
It's tough because I'm not very political to begin with, but since all these changes have been made, I'm heavily involved. I'm heavily involved. And I just wish that, you know, Lisa McLeod will, she doesn't even have to apologize. I don't think I need that or any other family needs that at this point. We all just want needs-based therapy based on individual needs, especially for children like my son or worse, who can have a better quality of life with ABA. Schools are not equipped right now to have our children in any form. I mean, my son only goes there one day a week, and I had issues with his previous school over basic communication in a booklet. And I mean, to the point where teachers were hanging up the phone on me, the principal yelled at me in front of people simply over communication. So imagine when 8,400 children who are receiving individual needs-based funding right now that are literally being forced back into the school system because we can't afford an additional $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year on especially such a short notice. And they're literally going to be forced to go back to schools because we have no other means financially to help them.
Let's just say hypothetically that the Doug Ford or Lisa McLeod are listening. And believe me, when I finish this podcast, and I'm going to ask you as well, I'm going to text Doug Ford because he said, hey, text me anytime, right? He gave us his phone number. So I'm going to tell him to listen to this episode. So let's pretend he's listening. What would you say to him if he were on the line right now? What would you say to him?
First and foremost, I know that they're human beings. And, you know, my hope is to understand that Lisa tried to help all children with autism because her intent was to clear the wait list. So there was a good intention, and I can understand that. But, she can't be continuing on this path of closing the doors, ignoring families, ignoring her constituents. I mean, this is not a proper way how to be an MPP, a government official, in any sort of a way. Doors need to be open and they need to hear our outcries. There are so many families in crisis. I am not the only one. And we need the help. And Canada is one of the richest countries in the world. And we can help these children have a better quality of life.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I'm on your side. And I know that there are many people out there. The tweet that I sent out of yours got a lot of reaction. And whatever we can do to help, we will. And I will do whatever I can to get your voice out there. Thank you so much for sharing your story. It really hammered it home to me. Your tweet put a face to everything that I've been hearing about. And there have been a lot of excellent. I'm speaking with Dr. Hannah Rasmussen later. And her husband have had the same issues. But your tweet, really, I could relate to it. And thank you for your advocacy and for everything that you do. And let's hope that we can, by putting faces to these efficiencies, that we can exact change. And thank you.
Thank you. And I quickly, if I can mention, I have met with my MPP, Rod Phillips. I'm in Ajax, once before, and I'm very thankful for his meeting and, you know, his responses. But we are waiting for a roundtable discussion. It's almost going to be summertime. We really need those roundtables to happen because we want our children's futures to basically be known. We're left in limbo right now. And I think that's why how you mentioned seeing a face to more than just speaking. I feel like it's important for all MPPs and every party to visit therapy centers who want to be regulated, who are great centers like my son's, that they should actually go visit and see what ABA actually does for our children.
Well, I think you're doing an excellent job in getting your story out there. And I think the more people share their stories, the more I'm hoping that it will force elected officials to see your side and to maybe take a more humanistic approach to this. And thank you very much, Susie. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Take care.
Next, I'll be speaking with Sarah Carlion. Sarah is an Ontario certified teacher with 12 years experience. She started her career as a high school English and history teacher, but has also had the opportunity to teach communications and multiculturalism at the post-secondary level. She is currently completing a Master's of Education at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and will hopefully be returning to the high school classroom in September. Well, I have Sarah Carlion on the podcast with me right now. We kind of met through Twitter speed dating, I guess you can call it. Of a friend of a friend contact, or I guess connected us together. So it's an absolute pleasure to have you on, Sarah.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I mean, you've given me, I guess, content for two podcasts. I had mentioned you, I guess, in a roundabout way in the last podcast. Yeah. But when I sent you the direct message to invite you on, and you have to repeat kind of what you replied to me.
Oh, I just said, well, because you apologized for the direct message. And I said, hey, it's not a dick pic, so it's all good.
And I'm not the most appropriate person. I think having seen my Twitter account, you can see that. But that generally, like, you know, people do that.
Yes, they do.
So, you know, but I knew at that point I had to have you on the podcast.
Okay, good. I felt really bad because I thought it was maybe too direct, but I'm glad you did.
No, I think somebody sending a picture of your privates to someone else is pretty direct. So
yes, it is.
Talking about it, I guess, is the first step.
Yeah.
But it did lead me to a roundabout, like, you know, kind of self-evaluation about how, you know, you approach social media and kind of the intentions of others, I guess, on social media. And, you know, that there's some real douchebags out there. In society who'd actually send a dick pic. So
yes, there are. And there are people who get very angry when you don't maybe want to communicate with them any further. And they, it's a crazy world out there.
Yes, definitely. It's a crazy, crazy social media out there.
Yes, it is.
I think everyone, you know, who knows me through Twitter, and I think we can all agree that it's a cray cray place. I can't believe I just said cray cray, but
you just said cray cray.
Yeah. See, I've been Twitterized. What can I say?
Yes, you have.
So, why don't you tell me a bit about yourself and your experience? Now, this podcast, we're talking with people who, you know, we're trying to put faces and names to the efficiencies, you know, Doug Ford's efficiencies, and, you know, trying to kind of, I guess, start a broader conversation about his cuts in his program changes having very real world consequences. And I find when you know someone who has been affected by it, it makes you much more of an advocate. So tell me a bit about yourself and your experience as an educator.
Okay. Well, I've been a teacher since 2007. I graduated from the University of Ottawa with my Bachelor of Education, and it hasn't been necessarily an easy road for me to get a full-time job. I work for it's a large school board, but it's a rural school board. So we're constantly dealing with issues of declining enrollment and various issues like that. And the way the government has always funded school boards is by bums and seats. So how many students do you have? This is how much money you get, regardless of how big your board is, regardless of how many schools you have. It's all dependent on how many students you have. So that could mean that we have, you know, I don't know how many schools we have, but we have a large amount of schools. But because we have small amounts of students, we have different classes with them. Like, you'll have like in one school, there was a split of like grades, kindergarten 1, 2, and 3. And just because of the funding for the school and the size of it. So it's been relatively hard for me to get a full-time job. I started off teaching with long-term occasionals and occasional teaching, supply teaching. And I landed my first contract, which means my first permanent section with the school board, which put me on the seniority list in September of 2010. So I was relatively lucky. I only had to wait 3 years to get onto the permanent list. And I had a maternity leave in there as well. So that, as a woman, that's one thing, that's a risk you have to take as an educator, is that you use or you lose some potential years to increase your entitlement and increase your seniority keeps going up. But if you don't get seniority before you go on maternity leave, that's another year that you are unable to have that opportunity. So I started off teaching one section at a school that was about an hour and 15 minutes away from me. So I was driving, I was probably spending more money in gas, but I was so happy because I was actually able to do what I love. I was finally in permanent with the board, and I kept having children and I kept increasing my entitlement as I went along. And I eventually got my full-time permanent position in 2014. So permanent since 2010, but full-time since 2014. And so it's been a struggle, but when you love what you do, it's not that big of a deal. And so I was moving along, but every year I would get surplused or I would be redundant. And that's just because of the nature of being a teacher in a small rural school board. So when you look at teachers in Toronto, they may have they may be at one school for most of their career, whereas like in a school board like mine, we're constantly moving schools until you're almost about 10, 15 years in. So I wanted to go back and do my master's, so I took leave from the board. So I have been on leave, but my seniority still continues. And I'm coming back this year, and I thought, hey, I have about 10 years of seniority, so a permanent position with the board for 10 years. I should be pretty safe. I shouldn't have to worry about being redundant. I shouldn't have to worry even about being bumped. And then these cuts came, and I started to get a little nervous, but I was talking to some of my union friends, and I'm like, you know, what are the chances? They're like, oh, no, you should be safe. You should be safe. And then I got the letter saying, no, you're redundant. And it was pretty devastating. I'm used to it. I haven't really been able to, I don't think there's been 1 year where I know where I'm teaching in September. There hasn't been 1 year that I've known where I'll be teaching in September. But this year should have been different. And it's not. So I would like to say that it's all the Ford government's fault. And this for this year, it is. It definitely is the Ford government's fault, because last year our redundancy line was at 2016. And this year it's back at 2010. So we lost a significant amount of positions. Yeah, so that's where I'm sitting right now, not knowing how I'm going to keep my house and feed my three children as a single mom. So, yeah. Would you like to ask me any questions regarding that? Sorry, I could just babble forever.
No, not at all. And this is, I've been told by my harshest critics, which would be my 16-year-old daughter, to just shut up and get out of the way. But I guess one question I would have is that I'm the spouse, my wife is an educator as well. And you have a lot of the same descriptions as she does. That education for her is a passion project. As much of it, it's a career. Mm-hmm. It's a passion that she has. But I guess with the redundancy notice, did it hit you harder because the stakes are higher because of the government? Like, yes. Was it vastly different feeling because of the government?
It is vastly different, because in the past, under the Liberals, we knew, like, I've always been terrified to vote conservative because I know how they feel about educators, and I've never liked the language that they had. So in the last election, it was Tim Hudak, and I remember telling my then husband, that who's a staunch conservative, that I was terrified that if he gets in, I'm going to lose my job. And he's like, no, it'll be fine. I said, no, it will not be good. And the Liberals, they did get in again, and that was a bit of relief, because I knew that they valued education. And our Minister of Education, the last few times, I think they were at least educators. And so I knew that when they were speaking to teachers, or when they were speaking about teachers, they had been there. So there was like an inherent value put on education. Whereas now with the new government, I feel like education is just some kind of commodity that they feel that they can cut. And that's the scary part, because when I got that redundancy notice, I don't know if I have a chance of getting a job. I can supply teach. That's great. And I'm teaching and I love that. And I will be happy to do that. And I'm not just saying that, you know, to make myself sound good. Like, I really do love supply teaching and I just love being with students, but I need some kind of consistency, and I need to know that even my own kids are going to have what they need in the classroom. And so there's this unease and this unrest within me and within my colleagues, because we don't know what's going to happen. And I always felt like with the Liberals, it was never really the government's funding that was sort of causing this unrest in our jobs. It was more of like the contracts and the union and everything, and how that intermingles. And it was always like, I just have to keep working. Once I get more seniority, it'll be fine. And this, I don't know what's going to happen. And I think that unknown, and knowing that my government doesn't value my kids and my students and what they need, is like, that to me is sickening and scary.
I understand the you know, the unease that you feel, that I know where my wife works, that, you know, that seems to be kind of one of the overriding moods. And I appreciate the professionalism of yourself and my wife and her colleagues, that I know that the unease is affecting them, but it doesn't appear to be moving into the realm of job performance. Do you notice with any of your coworkers that is it starting to seep in, I guess, kind of the personal worry to the professional, you know, the professional performance?
It is. I mean, we'll always put our students first. The really good teachers always do. But I just talking to some of my coworkers that are in the same cohort, so to speak, of graduation and seniority. And I remember talking to one of my coworkers, and she was telling me she caught her notice, and she's like, I just don't even want to be here. I just don't want to be here. I just want to go home and I just want to cry. And that's hard. And to sort of put on that brave face when we get those calls for being bumped in June, that's sometimes in the middle of the day and we have to go back and teach. So we're used to that. But I do think that it's really starting to impact us, and the stress with the upcoming negotiations for our contract. I'm also, so currently I'm working on my research looking at secondary mathematics teachers working with international students. And I've had to reschedule a few interviews with math teachers just because of maybe union meetings, or they're just stressed and they're getting behind. And it's just, it's all too much for them. And teaching is a very giving job. You give yourself physically and emotionally. And I think we're going to see a lot of burnout by the end of the year, just because of that added stress of the unknown of what's coming.
I mean, who would have thought, you know, choosing a goat farmer as an education minister would,
oh, I know.
Would lead to such uncertainty, right? I mean, it seems legit to me.
I mean, I love goats. So I remember when I found out she got the job, being in a rural school board, I was like, okay, so she likes 4-H. Maybe this will be good for my students, because she'll understand the needs of rural kids, because sometimes that's not always there when they're considering maybe the funding for certain schools and like the type of classes we need to offer for kids. And so sometimes it's like, it's really great to have someone who gets it, what it's like to be a country kid, because I'm not a country kid, but my students are. And some of them, they need different education. So I'm like trying to rationalize it in my head. I'm like, nope, she's still a goat farmer. This isn't going to go well.
She's treating it like goat farming. You know, she's always reminded me, and I'm trying not to insult, but you know, my daughter's, she's a huge Harry Potter fan, and she reminds me of, there's that character, the Dolores Umbridge.
Oh, Umbridge. She totally is an Umbridge.
Yeah. But she's like a redneck Umbridge. In my opinion, like redneck Umbridge. And no, I don't, but you know what? Let's avoid the ad hominem and attacks. Yeah, and
that's right.
So I guess kind of in closing, what I would ask you is that I'm sure that Doug Ford and Lisa Thompson or Lisa McLeod don't listen to the podcast. Although, since, you know, Doug Ford gives his phone number out, I'm going to text him the podcast and ask that he listens to it. So, and I'm sure he will, right? You know, Dougie seems to be right on with that stuff. So if seeing he's listening right now, what would you say to him if he was sitting here on the other side? What would you say to him?
That's a good question. I would tell him to actually sit down and consider the ramifications of what he's doing, not just to the kids right now, but think about it 7 generations from here on out. How is this going to impact? If we start taking money away from education, what does that mean for our future? What is that going to make our province look like? We're open for business. Well, if we don't have people who can actually understand the basics of business that teachers actually help to teach, what are we doing? How are we setting up the future? So although I'm not sure he'd fully understand what I just said. So that was mean. Sorry, that was awful, but
no, it's fair. You know, he doesn't seem to have a lot of empathy in regards to dealing with the people of Ontario. So I think that a lot of the criticisms and anger that go back to him is richly deserved. You know, I think back to the way Kathleen Wynne, I mean, that's an entirely different subject, but I think back to how previous premiers like Bob Rae or Kathleen Wynne were treated, and even Dalton McGuinty. And, you know, it comes with the territory. And I do not blame you for feeling that way. And I thought that you expressed yourself in an incredibly poignant way. And I appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate your time. And possibly in the future, if I could follow up with you to see how things are going. And, you know, I'd like to kind of follow up with the people I've spoken with today and see how things have, you know, changed or stayed the same. But thank you so much for being on, Sarah. And I'm going to stop recording here. Next, it's an absolute pleasure to have Dr. Hannah Rasmussen on the podcast today. On Twitter, @StandingHannah is where advocacy, facts, and resistance intersect to make an intensely on-point critic of the Doug Ford government. Hannah has 2 children with very different experiences of autism and has done postdoctoral work in healthcare innovation. Thank you for coming on the podcast. When I decided that I was going to, I guess, try and put a voice and names and faces to Doug Ford's efficiencies, that, your name kept coming up. And, you know, when I asked you or sent you that direct message, it was quite an honor to, you know, that you agreed to come on it. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I've been a big follower of you for quite a while, and I'm actually a fairly private person, so I'm still kind of confused by the fact that I do have a following, but I'm happy to have a voice to so many people that don't have a voice right now.
It kind of boggles my mind too that I've developed a following, but I find we both speak truth to certain issues. I kind of use a bit more snark and foul language in my assessments of people, but I have this platform and I might as well try and find a way to exact change or that, you know, advocate for causes that are important to me. Thank you for coming on. And I guess I have to ask you the burning question. Has Sam Oosterhoff called the police on you lately? Like the elderly women at his office?
No, I don't have the police called on me, but I did notice today, or last night actually, I tried to book tickets for an event that Lisa McLeod was scheduled at. And instead of getting tickets to it, I just got an email thanking me for my donation. So I'm not entirely sure, like, and I certainly can't claim this, but I booked it under my Twitter handle because that's where everything is for me. So I'm not sure if they're clearing on it or if it was a glitch, but I've had to protest it on my Visa because I didn't donate $50 to the Progressive Conservatives of Ontario. I tried to book two tickets and I didn't get my tickets. So they're not calling the cops on me, but something is happening. Well, to talk to the police about it. So,
wow. So it's almost the reverse of Oosterhoff, I guess we can call that.
Yeah. I call the police on them.
That's really, I mean, I read where you wrote that on Twitter, and I found that just to be so absolutely bizarre. I saw that and said, holy crap. Well, maybe not that language exactly, but.
To be honest, from my perspective, like, I used to work in IT. My PhD is in information systems. I get there are computer glitches, so I'm desperately hoping that it truly is a computer glitch, because I know other people that sent me the link and booked those tickets got a ticket thanking them for their donation, or an email rather, thanking them for their donation and then a ticket to the event. I just got an email thanking them for my donation. I hope it's an email glitch. I know there are a lot of email glitches, but there's also no way to contact them. I left a couple of voicemails to random Progressive Conservative Ontario email or phone calls, but no one's gotten back to me, and Visa's told me to escalate it. So I hope it's not, because that's just a huge nail in the coffin of what they stand for, or what I thought they stood for. But we'll go forward, and I have every intention of showing up to the event anyway.
It is pretty bad when you have to book tickets to go to an event to speak to your MPP, though, or to speak to an MPP or a cabinet minister. I mean, Lisa McLeod would have, what she does has a profound effect on your life. As you said, you have two children who have, I guess, vastly different experiences with autism, but making sure that you have her ear would be important to you. I think it's pretty bad that you have to book a ticket to an event to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's $50 that we don't have, because we're paying $82,000 a year for therapy right now for one child. And I'm not a progressive conservative supporter, so I'm countering that with the same amount to all of their other parties, just to even the field. So that suddenly we're looking at $200. And to have to do that just to try and connect with her a little bit. She's not my MPP, but she's in my area. Like, I live in Ottawa. She's apparently the MPP for the Conservatives that's in charge of this area. So to have to pay for access to her is, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's not Canadian democracy. It's horrifying.
I guess your only other option would be to, I don't know, take advertising with Ontario Proud or something. They seem to have the ear of the Ford government.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hate to support them. And I mean, there's a lot of different groups that seem to have the ear of the government that if I were in government, I wouldn't want them to have that sort of power. But you choose your enemies. No, parents are not in any good position right now.
You know, and speaking with a few other parents are involved in the Ontario Autism Program, previously on a wait list, one who wasn't. What is your experience, the difference between the two governments, between the Wynn Liberals and the Ford Progressive Conservatives?
So we have a slightly different perspective than a lot of the people, and we've learned a lot from the different families. And the only thing that really Lisa McLeod has done is unify all of these different experiences into one mass protest. And I think that was the exact opposite of what they thought they would happen. They thought that they would turn the kids, or the families of kids that were on the wait list would turn against the families of kids that were getting treatment. And it turned out that we all want treatment. We all want fair play. And they didn't expect that. So my kids didn't, they only got diagnosed 2 years ago. They've only ever experienced the wait list. We didn't have to protest Wynn, because literally my son was not alive when the Wynn protest started. He was born, he was diagnosed much after Wynn put it in her plan. And it was flawed because there was a wait list, but we knew the kids would eventually get off the wait list and get treatment. And instead, now we have the kids who are on a wait list and they won't get treatment. With Wynn, it was frustrating because we were waiting and we were waiting, and there were solutions to that and they weren't putting it in place. With McLeod, it is we're waiting and we're waiting, and whatever we're waiting for is not going to help our children. So we're at sort of this impasse of, we thought we had something to wait for, and now suddenly there's just nothing.
Now, one thing that I don't really understand is that a lot of these conservative MPPs are tweeting, saying how they're having their town halls or conference calls with parents regarding the OAP. Is this just lip service? Because normally you would have the consultation process before, you know, making these changes. Is this just kind of BS what they're doing now, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah. I used to run consultations and roundtables for a living. And I offered Jeremy in Ottawa, and I offered Lisa, and I've offered Amy McLeod. Like, I used to charge a lot of money to run these consultations, and I've offered to run them for free. So if it's really an economic issue, they're totally incompetent. You don't run consultations after you've implemented a plan. That's just a given. But the way they're running these consultations, so it's, you have to register with your email. And oddly enough, my email, I think, triggered a few things, so I didn't get chosen. You also have to be selected in and then screened for a comment. And then you have 30 seconds to say your comment. And Lisa McLeod isn't even there. So it's really, and a couple of really amazing Twitter people have pointed out, you're really just leaving Lisa McLeod a voicemail, a 30-second voicemail on how she is impacting the lives of children. And that's not a consultation. That's just for show. Because they know that they screwed up. They're still going forward with whatever they're doing. And they can't admit that they're wrong.
Do you feel that, you know, much as, you know, in 2016 when was going to put the age cap in, and it seemed like there were a lot of constructive protesting that happened, a lot of collaboration that happened, according to a few of the parents who were involved that I've spoken with. Do you think that there's, you know, because Doug Ford has shown a propensity at times to back down under public pressure. Do you feel that ship sailed with this, or do you feel that with continued resistance, perhaps, you know, the public outcry can change it?
It's so hard to say, because I mean I wasn't around for the original WIN protest. My kids weren't. My son wasn't even alive, and my daughter wasn't diagnosed. So I sort of knew about it on the periphery because one of my best friends' sons was autistic, and she was talking about it. But it's so hard to judge what Doug Ford will do, because I mean, from his behavior before, from everything that's coming out, I don't think he's actually the one making the decisions. So it's really hard to figure out what he'll do, if he's going to back down. Like, he may back down to save his political career, but if he's not the one making the decisions, then really, who knows what's going to happen? I feel like I have nothing to judge us on other than my own perceptions and what I've seen on Twitter and in the news, but the choices being made are not being made to save any particular political career. There's a higher thing going on, and a behind the scenes thing going on.
I would actually have to agree with you. I think Doug Ford sometimes, I mean, I haven't seen a government in a long time that is this poor in communication, especially when communicating changes to programs. It seems that they make the decision and then they do the communications process or the rollout afterwards. Like they don't think ahead with these things. The turmoil it's caused people who are affected by these changes, I don't really think they take an objective look at to what the effect is going to be on Ontarians.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I mean, this was a problem beforehand too. Like, I think I'm no fan of Doug Ford and his team, but like we went through a bit of the WIN experience, and it was super hard to navigate. And I mean, I jokingly say I'm super clever and I can figure this out. And you know, I've got the education, I've got the support, I've got the time, I can figure this out. And it is really hard to figure out the whole autism program and what we can apply for and where it is and all of that. And Doug Ford's team has not simplified matters. And I don't know if it's intentional or if it's just that they don't know what they're doing, so the communication has been terrible. But as like, I used to teach communications and marketing, and like this, they would get a failing grade in my course because they're almost intentionally not communicating with parents and with autistic children and adults, because I mean, this impacts everyone. It seems almost intentional or complete incompetence to me.
In closing, what I would ask you is there anything, I guess it would be kind of a two-pronged question, is there anything in this entire process that gives you hope? And I guess the follow-up to that would be, where do you see this heading, in your opinion, in your experience, you know, in your background? Because I do know that there's some policy background there.
I mean, I'm very new to government, so kind of knowing where this is going, I'm new to government. I'm quite new to the autism experience, and there's some amazing parents out there that have, like the OAC has gone through this for 15 years, and they keep fighting, and they're amazing at fighting. And the disability community in general has been fighting and knows that experience. Honestly, I have little to no hope on the Ford and McLeod and Amy Fee experience, and even Jeremy Roberts, unless Doug Ford gets taken down, which is entirely possible because it doesn't seem like a particularly robust and entangled group. Like they don't really seem like they're all coming from the same page right now. But I have little to no hope that anything is going to come of this. The consultations have been garbage. I mean, it's really just a case that they're trying to make up for how dodgy their first set was, but they're not doing anything different this time. And they didn't listen to women and men and children the first time, so why would they listen to them this time? They didn't listen to experts. They really aren't, they're not playing fair. So why would they do it this time if they didn't do it last time? So I really have no true hope on that. My biggest hope is that there's another coup d'etat and that Doug Ford gets taken down the same way that Patrick Brown did, and that we see someone else who is got more control over people, who actually sees the, if not the social justice cause for the fact that you should invest in children with disabilities, you should invest in autism, you should invest in public health. You can, if you don't see the social justice cause for that, you can see the economic cause for that. But the progressive conservatives have really lost just a ton of, if not branding. I mean, I used to teach marketing, so I talk a lot about branding, but they've lost their credibility in that. So, I mean, honestly, my biggest hope right now is that they screw everyone over. They're screwing over the seniors that go to Florida. They're now taking on education. They're taking on public health. Autism was really that bleeding edge. Our kids were really the starting point of all of this. And if they take on enough of us, then in 4 years, they're gone. That's really, I'm holding out for 4 years.
I've always had this theory when it comes to Doug Ford that if Andrew Scheer does not win an election, he won't be the conservative leader after the election. My theory always has been that Doug Ford has always had his eyes on running for the leadership of the federal conservative party. I mean, my hope is that Justin Trudeau does his job nationally, and that maybe the allure of the leadership will take care of Doug Ford. And further to your point that as the husband of an educator, you know, their union is getting ready in a way that I haven't seen them prepare in the past. You know, there are negotiations coming up for my wife's union, and I don't know, they're mobilizing in a way that I didn't see them mobilize, even when McGuinty tried to pass his previous education bill, that they're organizing in a way that they haven't been in with other unions, and the students are organizing. So what gives me hope, frankly, is the fact that there's people like you on Twitter, people like Mike. And I know there's a whole community of us now that we seem to kind of, I don't know, we don't communicate, we don't plan things, but we all seem to be on the same path. And that's the only thing that's really giving me hope right now, is that the resistance is going to be strong. And you know, I'm hoping for your sake and for your children's sake that something can be done about this. Whatever I can do on my end, I'm here to do. My platform is your platform if you need it.
Thank you. And I mean, it's funny. I mean, I used to teach marketing, and I used to teach operations management. So like, you would think that I offered my services for free. I am really good at what I do, like stupidly good at what I do. I'm really bad at other things, but I'm really good at what I do. And they haven't, like, Jeremy Roberts used to return my calls and used to talk to me about how he wanted to use my expertise and take advantage of everything that I did. And suddenly there's a clampdown and they all started clapping again, and Jeremy stops talking about his brother who has autism. And like, Jeremy told me on a phone call once that he thought his brother would have benefited from the same therapy that I'm spending $82,000 a year to get my son. So the hypocrisy of this group is mind-boggling. And just when they talk about economic issues, they're really not. Like, they're just, to have a voice at all in that is just, it's really important. And there's so many important voices on Twitter, and I hate having a voice. Like, I am extraordinarily vocal on Twitter because I have to be, because I'm fighting for my children, but it's just not my personality. And to know that there are other voices out there that are fighting for us and supporting us is really important, because it's a really hard battle. And it's a hard battle for the autism parents. It's a hard battle for adults on the spectrum, because they're having to do stuff that they're not necessarily comfortable or equipped for. It's a hard battle for special needs parents in general, parents of kids with disabilities, other adults on the spectrum. So we're all fighting this big battle against what is really a remarkably uncaring government, especially when Lisa McLeod today tweeted out that something along the lines of,
the best social program is a job.
Yeah, well, you know what? Fuck you, because not all kids, not all adults can have a job because they have special needs. And what are you going to do about those? And you're cutting, like, she is literally cutting the lifeline for some kids to be able to get a job. So she's either going to have to pay now, or her children will have to pay later.
Well, you might not be comfortable using your voice, but you're incredibly effective at it. I was, you know, explaining who you were to my wife, you know, because she's kind of new to the Twitter thing. I basically said you're a Twitter ass-kicking machine, because you're a fierce critic, but you do it well. And, you know, you're one of the people who give me motivation, and a lot of the people that I know. And, you know, just for whatever it's worth, know that you have a lot of allies out there, a lot of people who agree with your fight and will stand with you. And I'd like to thank you so much for coming on here. And I could hear the frustration in your voice, and I'm hoping that goes through to everybody who listens to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. And I mean, you were one of my first Twitter followers. I've only been on Twitter for 6 months, 7 months or so. And I keep recommending you to everyone, because I mean, you call it the way you see it. I don't always agree with it, but 9 times out of 10, I really do. And I think we need more voices that are passionate on Twitter, because there's so much rubbish out there.
This government for the people thing has just kind of turned into a government against the people. And, you know, thank you for recommending me. And I know a lot of people don't always agree with everything that I say, but I try to bring passion and fact into it, and I can see that you're similar.
That's my goal. So I'm very happy to chat with you, and I think between us we can reach to a lot to people that might not really understand what's going on with both this file, but so many other files that this impacts on, because we are really that cutting edge of, once you start to, you can cut the autistic kids, and then you can cut the disabled kids, and then you can cut the special, or like the other kids, and then you start to cut into all sorts of things. We're that test market for all of this bullshit that the Ford government's planning.
Well, I hope that we can put a stop to it here. I do know that we can mobilize a lot of people. And thank you for your time, Hannah. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. And I'm hoping that, you know, afterwards, some of the people I've spoken with, that to follow up in the future, if you'd like to come on again later for that, or if there's anything you want to discuss, I'd love to have you on.
I would love to, because our son is in fully privatized therapy, and he's a week and a half into it, and he is just thriving. So I would love to give you updates and talk to you about all of that nonsense.
All right, then. Thank you very much.
Neither before Zod!
I would like to thank my guests, Susie Panofska-Guarsi, Sarah Carlion, and Dr. Hannah Rasmussen on the podcast. Now that we have names and faces to match Doug Ford's cuts, I hope that we can stand together as a community and as a province to resist these cruel cuts. As always, I welcome your suggestions and ideas. I can be found on Twitter at That's Mr. Neil. For any complaints and criticisms, I can be reached by email. That's doug.ford@pc.ol.org. Thank you for listening.
Nero before Zog!
I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, Patreon, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader.